This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Middle East peace process might never have gotten as far as it has without the work of Hanan Ashrawi. The Arab-American writer Edward Said described her as the creator and speaker of the new language of the Palestinians. In the minds of many Westerners, she replaced the image of the terrorist with the image of an intellectual in a tailored suit who could speak movingly about her people's history and use the language of diplomacy to discuss their future. Ashrawi is a former English professor at Birzeit University in the West Bank. She was a spokesperson for the Palestinian delegation at the peace talks. The secret peace talks in Oslo developed out of a meeting held at her house. Ashrawi has written a new memoir called This Side of Peace, A Personal Account. She now heads the Palestinian Independent Commission for Citizens' Rights, a group she founded. I asked her to tell us what it does.
Well, the commission actually is a system of accountability. It is a combination of ombudsman, the Scandinavian tradition of ombudsman, and the universal tradition of state controller, as well as part of the Arab Islamic tradition of the court of grievances, having recourse to an address to present grievances against the authority. So in some ways it's a watchdog. It is also one of the institutions of civil society, in order to ensure the rule of law, to ensure that the laws are applied uniformly and justly, and that the legal system itself is just. And we also monitor the activities of the national authority and the PLO to ensure against the abuse of authority and misuse of public funds, and to safeguard basic rights and freedoms. So it's a very tall order.
Right. Now, I'm wondering why you chose to do this instead of choosing to join the Palestinian Authority. And Yasser Arafat urged you to join it. He really wanted you to become part of the authority.
Well, I guess it's a question of commitment, a question of principle, and a question of knowing where your priorities lie. I feel that building a state and the whole process and challenge of nation building has to focus on institutions of civil society, on translating these principles of democracy and accountability and human rights into actual working systems and structures, and to ensure that whatever system of government we have is firmly ingrained and rooted in these principles. And I felt that this would allow us to work outside the confines of just Gaza, Jericho, geographically, or the constraints of a very flawed agreement and a very difficult transitional period.
The Palestinian Authority has been holding closed trials of Islamic militants who were accused of acts of terrorism. You've, I believe, called for the disbanding of this particular court. How come?
Yes. Well, first of all, these are military courts. This is called the State Security Court, which certainly is based on very negative models, whether in the Arab world or elsewhere. And the legal system it follows is based on the British emergency regulations or the Egyptian military orders. And these, in many ways, or essentially, are violations of civil and human rights. The courts themselves, of course, violate the independence of the judiciary in the sense that the executive has the right to intervene. And, of course, it's a military court, and the judges are three military officers. And at the same time, the whole way in which the courts have been holding sessions at night in the wee hours of dawn or pre-dawn, very quick trials without the accused knowing the nature of the charges or without having the chance to appoint a lawyer, and quite often, summons go out to witnesses at all sorts of strange hours. So in many ways they are not conducive to a due process or a just implementation of the law. And we see them in many ways as catering to Israeli priorities and needs, rather than to Palestinian priorities and needs. And I don't think you should try Palestinians because Israel insists that you try them. You cannot start abusing people's rights in order to show that you can deliver to the Israelis the security of Israelis. I doubt whether the Israelis would at any point, arrest Israelis massively in order to demonstrate to the Palestinians that they care about our security.
I know that when Yasser Arafat tries to crack down on terrorists, he is often perceived as being a pawn of Israel.
Yes, he's been accused by the opposition to have been reduced to the level of an instrument of Israeli security. Now, I think that's quite reductive, and I describe this as being very ironic, because the Israelis in 28 years could not maintain security under occupation, using the strongest army in the region and using the most brutal repressive measures. So I don't see how they can expect the Palestinian National Authority or President Arafat to deliver their security to them using the same means. So the question is, where do you get stability and security? Only from addressing the issues that cause instability and that instigate violence. And this process, ironically, has undermined the Palestinian leadership and has pitted it against its own people, so to speak, in many ways, because it is being asked to show that it can deliver, it can represent the Palestinian people by putting an end to acts of violence or acts of resistance. And at the same time, it is being asked by its own people, not just to safeguard their own rights, but not to prevent acts of resistance from areas that are still under occupation. You see, there's this whole myth that the occupation is finished, that the Palestinian question is solved, and that the peace process is producing results, or that we have peace. And unfortunately, this is not the case. Most of Palestinian land is still under occupation, so are most of the Palestinian people. And the Israeli practices are business as usual. I mean, there are still massive arrests. There are 6,000 Palestinians in prisons. The whole area of collective punitive measures is still practiced by the occupation, whether in terms of closure or curfews. And at the same time, they want the Palestinians to behave as though the occupation is a figment of our imagination. And that's not the case at all. We have to deal not with the peace process as a verbal exercise, but with a reality that has to be transformed in order to show that the peace process can actually change people's lives.
I know you were very unhappy with the speech that Arafat gave at the signing of the peace agreement on the White House lawn.
Yes.
What was your problem with what he said? What were you hoping for?
Well, I said we didn't recognize ourselves in it. I mean, it was like a regressive speech, a throwback to these cliches and slogans, to sort of dealing with abstract politics in very reductive terms. It lacked the intellectual vigor, it lacked the emotional candor, it lacked the human substance and honesty that, for example, characterized our Madrid speech. And at that point, I felt that we were being taken back to the politics of exclusion rather than inclusion, rather than creating common terms of reference and a shared language of humanity and shared perceptions. We were being excluded as the reductive people who use the stilted word and the empty slogan. And that, I found, was an insult to our humanity and to our collective history, as well as to our aspirations.
You probably thought it was a big missed opportunity also, huh?
Well, yes, in practical terms, it certainly was. I remember when I had written a draft of a speech, and some of the people on the executive committee looked at it, they said, well, he's not a poet, and he's not an intellectual, and this is poetry and an intellectual speech, so he has to talk politics. I said, if politics does not have poetry and creativity and does not have the human substance and the intellectual perception, then certainly it has lost its core. I mean, it has lost its legitimacy.
Was this a speech that you'd written for Arafat to give at the signing, or was that another speech you're referring to?
I had written a speech for Arafat to read in Washington.
What did you say?
I tried to recall the collective history of the Palestinians as well as the cumulative struggle of the Palestinians, and to bring together the two wounded parts, you know, the Palestinians in exile, life in refugee camps, as well as the Palestinians under occupation. And this dual pain, I felt, had to be reconciled and presented as a unified vision, and to place ourselves in the midst of humanity, in the midst of human perceptions, that we have taken the decision to forge ahead, to move forward, to unite these components, and at the same time to reach out not just to the Israelis or to the adversaries, but to each other and to ourselves and to humanity as a whole. And I also tried to find the common grounds, spiritual grounds, existential grounds, even religious grounds, in Christian, Muslim, and Jewish terms, in order to articulate this common message. And that in this process, there should be no winner or loser, that peace should be triumphant for everybody, because that's the only way we can save our common humanity.
So what are some of the things that went through your mind during the signing of a peace of the peace agreement? Things that, of course, you'd be willing to share with us.
Well, yes, I described part of it in the book. And in some ways, I described this process as another minefield. I said the easy part is over, now begins the difficult part. We had wrenched the course of history in order to legitimize the language of reconciliation and to create the attitude of courage that deals with peacemaking not as an act of capitulation, but as an act of will, and a triumphant will at that, for everybody involved. So I was sitting there listening to this reductive speech and at the same time listening to the Israelis speak. My friend Mahmoud Darwish, the Palestinian poet, told me Rabin gave our speech. He usurped our history. And we should have given that speech. And I felt that there is an injustice there. But at the same time, I also knew that the tasks ahead were much more difficult. I knew that this was a very precarious peace, that the agreement is flawed, that it's going to take everything we've got in order to be able to translate it into a living reality. I knew that we had embarked on this unique process, I called it, of signing first and negotiating later. And we needed to negotiate the details, the steps of implementation, the concrete aspects of this agreement in ways that would not contain self-destruct mechanisms or seeds of future conflict.
My guest is Hanan Ashrawi. She was spokesperson for the Palestinian delegation to the Middle East peace talks. Now she heads the Palestinian Independent Commission for Citizens' Rights. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Hanan Ashrawi is my guest. She's written a memoir called This Side of Peace. I'd be interested in hearing what I would imagine would be pretty complicated feelings about Hamas, the Islamic resistance movement, the more extremist Islamic resistance movement. On the one hand, on some level, I'm sure you share some of its beliefs for, you know, in independence and a Palestinian state. On the other hand, I can only assume you don't share its tactics of getting that through acts of terrorism. Also, if the Islamic resistance movement took over Palestine, what room would that leave for you as a woman and as a Christian?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, I think, a very central question, because we have been subject to this simplistic type of polarization. People perceive us either as being with the authority, with all its sins forgiven, regardless of ineptitude or corruption or whatever, or the only alternative being Hamas. And I kept saying, no, we have a whole spectrum of political opinion and political organizations that are basically and essentially democratic and humanistic, and that are neither one of these two options. And that's what we have to encourage. Now, Hamas, as far as I'm concerned, is part of this political pluralism. And on the whole, Hamas is a political movement. It does have a military wing. And of course, I disagree with any kind, not only disagree, I mean, I'm totally appalled by any act of violence against any individual, by anybody. And therefore, I feel it's neither justified nor legitimate nor acceptable in any way to carry out any kinds of violence against civilians and to target innocent victims in order to make a political point, be they Palestinian or be they Israeli. So these tactics, as you said, yes, I disagree with and I totally denounce. But at the same time, I feel that the way in which to deal with Hamas is to create the mechanisms of democratic involvement, to have an inclusive, participatory democratic system, particularly through elections, to protect Hamas's right to differ. And we said this in the Madrid speech. We said we have an opposition, and we will defend the right to oppose and to differ all the time. provided they use legitimate political democratic means. So we have to create those means, those channels, those structures, to include the whole political spectrum, because any exclusion is an invitation to violence.
I think a dilemma a lot of people face in situations like this is if, you know, you fight democratically, but if this other group, you know, the fundamentalist group comes into power, then democracy is closed down, because fundamentalist-run societies tend to not be pluralistic societies.
Yeah, but you can't be selective about democracy and say, I will apply it only when the results suit me, and if the results don't suit me, then I will negate the democratic process, which is what happened in Algiers, for example. I don't believe that you can distort your own society in order to cater to your own needs, or to say, I'm going to protect democracy by being undemocratic, or I'm going to stifle others in order to protect my freedom of expression and speech. No, I think you have to create the conditions so that the voice that wins is the voice of reason.
Hanan Ashrawi is my guest, and she's written a memoir called This Side of Peace. I'd like to talk with you a little bit about your life. You were born in the last part of the period when Palestine was a British mandate. Tell us a little bit about where you lived and what your family was like then.
Well, actually, when I was born, it was the beginning of the end for Palestine, because in 1947, as you know, I was born in the end of 1946. In 1947, the UN Resolution 181 created the what we call the two-state solution, but only half of it was implemented, and the State of Israel was created, and Palestine disappeared, so to speak. So in many ways, the basic factors that influenced my life took place either just after I was born or before I had any sense of awareness of what was happening. My father was a doctor in the Palestine army, so he was moving from one city to another in Palestine, and as I said, having a daughter in every place, in every town they lived in. I was number five among five daughters, and strangely enough, I wasn't born in Ramallah itself, I was born in Nablus. And my parents immediately moved to Tiberias. So when the 1948 war took place, they were in Tiberias, and I was a baby. And they had to be smuggled out of Tiberias. I described it in my book by a Jewish doctor friend of his, Dr. Efrati, actually, who helped them escape Tiberias, and they went to Jordan, to Amman, Jordan. My father came back to Palestine and helped for a while there, before finally the whole family went back to Ramallah, which is the ancestral homeland of my father, the town where he comes from. And that's where I grew up all alone.
You said that your father believed in equality for women. How did he let you know that when you were a girl?
Oh, from the beginning. It's not just a question of words or ideology. Actually, he didn't have many words. He was economical at the verbal level. But in the way he treated us, in the way he brought us up, in the way he would not allow any kind of social intrusion in our lives to define the parameters or limits of our own endeavor as women. He kept saying, you can do whatever you want to do as a human being, and don't accept any imposed limits on you. And, for example, he took it for granted that we would all go to universities, we would all be educated people, that we will all work as his daughters. He took it for granted that they would not in any way interfere in our basic life decisions, whether marriage or education or career, that they would raise us to have the confidence and ability to forge ahead. And I remember he always had this statement that was a favorite of ours, saying you have to be, in the pursuit of what is right, you have to be strong.
You thank your family in your memoir for loaning you to the peace process. Mm-hmm. How do you think your family changed to manage things in your absence? I think your husband is an artist and musician. Is he home a lot? Did he take care of the kids a lot while you were gone?
Yes, certainly. He said it gave him the chance to enjoy fatherhood. I remember in one interview he was asked if he was... He said he spends most of his time with the girls, with our daughters, and at home, and the garden, and so on. And one woman interviewer told him, well, we call that a house husband. And he said, no, I call that being a father. And he has always lamented the fact that men have not really had the opportunity to fully enjoy the experience of fatherhood or parenthood in ways that women traditionally, could. And he felt that it was unfair and there had to be a real sharing. But in our case, a conscious decision had to be taken by us, by the nuclear family, for Emil, for my husband, to take over many of the tasks that normally would be shared by both of us, and to try to fill in for me in my absence and my incredibly difficult schedule and tasks. And we evolved a very open and frank and warm relationship with the daughters, where we discussed everything beforehand and we took decisions collectively. And they knew that I'm there for them whenever they needed me, but they also knew that I was doing something much larger than my immediate presence. As my daughter Zena said, we lent my mother to peace so that she can go out and make peace and spend more time with us.
Hanan Ashrawi, she's written a new memoir called This Side of Peace. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.